Side 3. Rising Sun by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 90. The woman leaned forward to kiss the bald man lightly on the mouth. Then she stepped back and made some comment about the suit he was wearing.
"She's a lawyer in the DA's office," Jenny said. "Lauren Davis. She's assisted on a couple of big cases. The Sunset Strangler, the Kellerman shooting. She's very ambitious, smart, and well-connected. They say she has a future if she stays in the office. It must be true, because Weiland doesn't ever let her get airtime. As you see, she makes a good appearance, but he keeps her away from the microphones. The bald guy she's talking to is John McKenna, with Regis McKenna in San Francisco, the company that does the publicity for most high-tech firms." I said, "We can go forward." Jenny pushed the button.
"Is she really your wife, or is your partner kidding?"
"No, she's really my wife."
"Was.
You're divorced now?"
"Yeah."
Jenny looked at me and started to say something. Then she decided not to and looked back at the screen. On the monitor, the party continued at high speed. I found myself thinking of Lauren. When I knew her, she was bright and ambitious, but she really didn't understand very much. She had grown up privileged, she had gone to Ivy League schools, and had the privileged person's deep belief that whatever she happened to think was probably true. Certainly good enough to live by. Nothing needed to be checked against reality. She was young, that was part of it. She was still feeling the world, learning how it worked. She was enthusiastic, and she could be impassioned in expounding her beliefs. But of course her beliefs were always changing, depending on whom she had talked to last. She was very impressionable. She tried on ideas the way some women try on hats. She was always informed on the latest trend. I found it youthful and charming for a while, until it began to annoy me. Because she didn't have any core, any real substance. She was like a television set. She just played the latest show. Whatever it was, she never questioned it. In the end, Lauren's great talent was to conform. She was expert at watching the TV, the newspaper, the boss, whatever she saw as the source of authority, and figuring out what direction the winds were blowing, and positioning herself so she was where she ought to be. I wasn't surprised she was getting ahead. Her values, like her clothes, were always smart and up to date.
"To you, Lieutenant, but it's getting late."
"Lieutenant?"
I blinked and came back. Jenny was talking to me. She pointed to the screen, where a frozen image showed Cheryl Austin in her black dress, standing with two older men in suits. I looked over at Connor, but he had turned away and was talking on the telephone.
"Lieutenant, this of interest to you?"
"Yes, sure. Who are they?"
Jenny started the tape. It ran at normal speed.
"Senator John Morton and Senator Stephen Rowe. They're both on the Senate Finance Committee. The one that's been having hearings about this microcon sale."
On the screen, Cheryl laughed and nodded. In motion, she was remarkably beautiful, an interesting mixture of innocence and sexuality. At moments, her face appeared knowing and almost hard. She appeared to know both men, but not well. She did not come close to either of them, or touch them except to shake hands. For their part, the senators seemed acutely aware of the camera, and maintained a friendly, if somewhat formal, demeanor.
"Our country's going to hell, and on a Thursday night, United States senators are standing around chatting with models," Jenny said. "No wonder we're in trouble. And these are important guys. They're talking about Morton as a presidential candidate in the next election."
I said, "What do you know about them personally?"
"They're both married. Well, Rose semi-separated. His wife stays home in Virginia. He gets around. Tends to drink too much."
I looked at Rowe on the monitor. He was the same man who had gotten on the elevator with us earlier in the evening. And he had been drunk then, almost falling down. But he wasn't drunk now.
"And Morton?"
"Supposedly he's Mr. Clean. Ex-athlete, fitness nut, eats health food, family man. Morton's big area is science and technology, the environment. American competitiveness, American values, all that. But he can't be that clean. I've heard he has a young girlfriend."
"Is that right?"
She shrugged.
"The story is, his staffers are trying to break it off. But who knows what's true?
The tape ejected, and Jenny pushed in the next one. This is the last, fellas. Connor hung up the phone and said, "Forget the tape." He stood. "We've got to go, Kohai."
"Why?"
"I've been talking to the phone company about the calls made from the payphone in the lobby of the Nakamoto building between 8 and 10.
"And?"
"No calls were made during those hours." I knew that Connor thought that someone had gone out of the security room and called from the payphone. Cole, or one of the Japanese. Now his hopes of following a promising lead by tracing the call were dashed.
"That's too bad," I said.
"Too bad?" Connor said, surprised. "It's extremely helpful. It narrows things down considerably. Miss Gonzalez, do you have any tapes of people leaving the party?"
"Leaving?"
"No. Once the guests arrived, all the crews went upstairs to shoot the actual party. Then they brought the tape back here to make the deadline, while the party was still going on."
"Fine. Then I believe we're finished here. Thanks for your help. Your knowledge is remarkable. Kohai, let's go."
Driving again. This time to an address in Beverly Hills. By now it was after 1 in the morning and I was tired. I said, "Why does the payphone in the lobby matter so much?"
"Because," Connor said, "our whole conception of this case revolves around whether someone made a call from that phone or not. The real question now is, which company in Japan has locked horns with Nakamoto?"
"Which company in Japan?" I said.
"Yes, it is clearly a corporation belonging to a different Keiretsu," Connor said.
I said, "Keiretsu?"
"The Japanese structure their businesses in large organizations they call Keiretsu. There are 6 major ones in Japan, and they're huge. For example, the Mitsubishi Keiretsu consists of 700 separate companies that work together or have interrelated financing or interrelated agreements of various sorts. Big structures like that don't exist in America because they violate our antitrust laws. But they are the norm in Japan. We tend to think of corporations as standing alone. To see it the Japanese way, you'd have to imagine, say, an association of IBM and Citibank and Ford and Exxon, all having secret agreements among themselves to cooperate and to share financing or research. That means a Japanese corporation never stands alone. It's always acting in partnership with hundreds of other companies, and in competition with the companies of other Keiretsu. So when you think about what Nakamoto Corporation is doing, you have to ask what the Nakamoto Keiretsu is doing back in Japan, and what companies in other Keiretsu oppose it. Because this murder is embarrassing to Nakamoto, it could even be seen as an attack against Nakamoto."
"An attack?"
"Think about it. Nakamoto plans a great star-studded opening night for their building. They want it to go perfectly. For some reason, a guest at the party gets strangled. And the question is, who called it in?"
"Who reported the murder?"
"Right. Because after all, Nakamoto controls that environment completely. It's their party, their building. And it would be a simple matter for them to wait until 11 o'clock, after the party was over and the guests had left, to report the murder. If I were preoccupied with appearances, with the nuances of public face, that's the way I'd do it. Because anything else is potentially dangerous to the corporate image of Nakamoto."
"Okay. But the report wasn't delayed," Connor said.
"On the contrary, somebody called it in at 8:32, just as the party was getting underway, thus putting the whole evening at risk. And our question has always been, who called it in?"
I said, "You told Ishigura to find the person who called, and he hasn't done it yet."
"Correct, because he can't."
"He doesn't know who called it in?"
"Correct."
"You don't think anybody from the Nakamoto Corporation made the call?"
"Correct."
"An enemy of Nakamoto called?"
"Almost certainly."
I said,
"So how do we find out who called the report in?"
Connor laughed. "That's why I checked the lobby phone. It's crucial to that question."
"Why is it crucial?"
"Suppose you worked for a competing corporation
and you want to know what's going on inside Nakamoto. You can't find out because Japanese corporations hire their executives for life. The executives feel they are part of a family, and they'd never betray their own family. So Nakamoto Corporation presents an impenetrable mask to the rest of the world, which makes even the smallest details meaningful. Which executives are in town from Japan? Who is meeting with whom? Comings and goings, and so on. And you might be able to learn those details if you strike up a relationship with an American security guard who sits in front of monitors all day. Particularly if that guard has been subjected to Japanese prejudice against blacks. Go on, I said. The Japanese often try to bribe local security officers from rival firms. The Japanese are honorable people, but their tradition allows such behavior. All's fair in love and war, and the Japanese see business as war. Bribery is fine, if you can manage it. Okay. Now, in the first few seconds after the murder, we can be certain of only two people who knew a girl had been killed. One is the killer himself. The other is the security guard, Ted Cole, who watched it on the monitors.
Wait a minute. Ted Cole watched it on the monitors? He knows who the killer is?
Obviously.
He said he left at 8:15.
He was lying.
But if you knew that, then why didn't we...
He'll never tell us, Connor said. The same way Phillips won't tell us. That's why I didn't arrest Cole, bring him down for questioning. In the end, it would be a waste of time. And time is of the essence here. We know he won't tell us. My question is, did he tell anyone else?
I began to see what he was driving at.
You mean, did he walk out of the security office to the lobby payphone and call somebody to tell them that a murder had occurred? Correct. Because he wouldn't use the phone in his office. He'd use the payphone and call somebody. An enemy of Nakamoto, a competing corporation. Somebody.
I said, but now we know that no calls were made from that phone.
Correct, Connor said. So your whole line of reasoning collapses. Not at all. It is clarified. If Cole didn't notify anybody, then who phoned in the murder? Clearly, the source can only be the murderer himself. I felt a chill.
He called it in to embarrass Nakamoto?
Presumably, Connor said.
Then where did he call from?
That's not clear yet. I assume from somewhere inside the building. And there are a few other confusing details that we have not begun to consider.
Such as?
The car phone rang. Connor answered it and handed the receiver to me. It's for you.
No, no, Mrs. Asenio said. The baby is fine. I checked on her a few minutes ago. She is fine, Lieutenant. I wanted you to know Mrs. Davis called.
That was how she referred to my ex-wife.
When? I think 10 minutes ago.
Did she leave a number?
No. She says she can't be reached tonight, but she want you to know. Something has come up, and maybe she go out of town. So she say maybe she don't take the baby this weekend.
I sighed. Okay.
She says she call you tomorrow and let you know for sure.
Okay. I wasn't surprised. It was typical Lauren. Last-minute changes. You could never make plans involving Lauren because she was always changing her mind. Probably this latest change meant that she had a new boyfriend and she might go away with him. She wouldn't know until tomorrow. I used to think all this unpredictability was bad for Michelle, that it would make her insecure. But kids are practical. Michelle seems to understand that's the way her mother is, and she doesn't get upset. I'm the one who gets upset. Mrs. Asenio said, "You coming back soon, Lieutenant?"
"No, it looks like I'll be out all night."
"Can you stay?"
"Yes, but I have to leave by 9 in the morning. You want I pull out the couch?"
I had a couch bed in the living room. She used it when she stayed over.
"Yes, sure."
"Okay, goodbye, Lieutenant."
"Goodbye, Mrs. Asenio."
Connor said, "Anything wrong?" I was surprised to hear tension in his voice.
"No, just my ex pulling her usual shit. She's not sure she'll take the baby this weekend." Why?
Connor shrugged. Just asking. I didn't think that was all there was to it. I said,
What did you mean earlier, when you said that this case could turn ugly?
It may not, Connor said. Our best solution is to wrap it up in the next few hours, and I think we can. Here's the restaurant up ahead on the left. I saw the neon sign, Bora Bora.
This is the restaurant owned by Sakamura?
Yes. Actually, he's just a part owner. Don't let the valet take the car. Park it in the red. We may need to leave quickly. The Bora Bora was this week's hot L.A. restaurant. The decor was a jumble of Polynesian masks and shields. Lime green wooden outriggers jutted out over the bar like teeth. Above the open kitchen, a Prince video played ghost-like on an enormous 5-meter screen. The menu was Pacific Rim. The noise deafening. The clientele movie industry hopeful. Everyone was dressed in black. Connor smiled. It looks like Trader Vic's after a bomb went off, doesn't it? Stop staring. Don't they let you out enough?
No, they don't, I said.
Connor turned to speak to the Eurasian hostess. I looked at the bar, where two women kissed briefly on the lips. Farther down, a Japanese man in a leather bomber jacket had his arm around a huge blonde. They were both listening to a man with thinning hair and a pugnacious manner whom I recognized as the director of...
Come on, Connor said to me. Let's go. What?
Eddie's not here.
Where is he?
At a party in the hills. Let's go. The address was on a winding road in the hills above Sunset Boulevard. We would have had a good view of the city up here, but the mist had closed in. As we approached, the street was lined on both sides with luxury cars. Mostly Lexus sedans, with a few Mercedes convertibles and Bentleys. The parking attendants looked surprised as we pulled up in our Chevy sedan and headed up to the house. Like other residences on the street, the house was surrounded by a 3-meter wall, the driveway closed off with a remote-controlled steel gate. There was a security camera mounted above the gate and another at the path leading up to the house itself. A private security guard stood by the path and checked our badges. I said, Whose house is this? 10 years ago, the only people in Los Angeles who maintained such elaborate security were either mafioso or stars like Stallone whose violent roles attracted violent attention. But lately it seemed everybody in wealthy residential areas had security. It was expected, almost fashionable. We walked up steps through a cactus garden toward the house, which was modern, concrete, and fortress-like. Loud music played. This house belongs to the man who owns Maxine Noir. He must have seen my blank look. It's an expensive clothing store, famous for its snotty salespeople. Jack Nicholson and Cher shop there.
Jack Nicholson and Cher, I said, shaking my head. How do you know about it?
Many Japanese shop at Maxine Noir now. It's like most expensive American stores. It'd go out of business without visitors from Tokyo. It's dependent on the Japanese. As we approached the front door, a large man in a sport coat appeared. He had a clipboard with names.
I'm sorry, it's by invitation only, gentlemen.
Connor flashed his badge. We'd like to speak to one of your guests, he said.
Which guest is that, sir?
Mr. Sakamura.
He didn't look happy. Wait here, please. From the entryway, we could see into the living room. It was crowded with partygoers who, at a quick glance, seemed to be many of the same people who had been at the Nakamoto reception.
As in the restaurant, almost everyone was wearing black. But the room itself caught my attention. It was stark white, entirely unadorned. No pictures on the wall, no furniture, just bare white walls and a bare carpet. The guests looked uncomfortable. They were holding cocktail napkins and drinks, looking around for some place to put them. A couple passed us on their way to the dining room.
Rod always knows what to do, she said.
Yes, he said, so elegantly minimalist. The detail in executing that room.
I don't know how he ever got that paint job. It's absolutely perfect. Not a brush stroke, not a blemish.
a perfect surface.
Well, it has to be, she said. It's integral to his whole conception.
It's really quite daring, the man said.
Daring? I said.
What are they talking about? It's just an empty room.
Connor smiled. I call it faux zen, style without substance.
I scanned the crowd.
Senator Morton's here.
He was standing in the corner holding forth, looking very much like a presidential candidate.
So he is.
The guard hadn't returned, so we stepped a few feet into the room. As I approached Senator Morton, I heard him say,
Yes, I can tell you exactly why I'm disturbed about the extent of Japanese ownership of American industry. If we lose the ability to make our own products, we lose control over our destiny. It's that simple. For example, back in 1987, we learned that Toshiba sold the Russians critical technology that allowed the Soviets to silence their submarine propellers. Russian nuclear subs now sit right off the coast and we can't track them because they got technology from Japan. Congress was furious, and the American people were up in arms. And rightly so, it was outrageous. Congress planned economic retaliation against Toshiba. But the lobbyists for American companies pleaded their case for them because American companies like Hewlett-Packard and Compaq were dependent on Toshiba for computer parts. They couldn't stand a boycott because they had no other source of supply. The fact was, we couldn't afford to retaliate. They could sell vital technology to our enemy, and there wasn't a damn thing we could do about it. That's the problem. We're now dependent on Japan. And I believe America shouldn't be dependent on any nation.
Somebody asked a question, and Morton nodded.
Yes, it's true that our industry is not doing well. Real wages in this country are now at 1962 levels. The purchasing power of American workers is back where it was 30-odd years ago. And that matters even to the well-to-do folks that I see in this room, because it means American consumers don't have the money to see movies, or buy cars, or clothing, or whatever you people have to sell. The truth is, our nation is sliding badly.
A woman asked another question I couldn't hear, and Morton said,
Yes, I said 1962 levels. I know it's hard to believe, but think back to the 50s, when American workers could own a house, raise a family, and send the kids to college, all on a single paycheck. Now both parents work and most people still can't afford a house. The dollar buys less. Everything is more expensive. People struggle just to hold on to what they have. They can't get ahead.
I found myself nodding as I listened. About a month before, I had gone looking for a house, hoping to get a backyard for Michelle. But housing prices were just impossible in L.A. I was never going to be able to afford one unless I remarried. Maybe not even then, considering... I felt a sharp jab in the ribs. I turned around and saw the doorman. He jerked his head toward the front door.
Back, fella.
I was angry. I glanced at Connor, but he just quietly moved back to the entrance. In the entryway, the doorman said,
I checked. There's no Mr. Sakamura here.
Mr. Sakamura, Connor said, is the Japanese gentleman standing at the back of the room, to your right, talking to the redhead.
The doorman shook his head. I'm sorry, fellas. Unless you have a search warrant, I'll have to ask you to leave.
There isn't a problem here, Connor said. Mr. Sakamura is a friend of mine. I know he'd like to talk to me.
I'm sorry. Do you have a search warrant?
No, Connor said.
Then you're trespassing, and I'm asking you to leave.
Connor just stood there. The doorman stepped back and planted his feet wide.
He said, I think you should know I'm a black belt.
Are you really?
Connor said.
So is Jeff, the doorman said, as a second man appeared.
Jeff, Connor said, are you the one who'll be driving your friend here to the hospital?
Jeff laughed meanly.
Hey, you know I like humor. It's funny.
Okay, Mr. Wise Guy, you're in the wrong place. You've had it explained.
Move out.
Now. He poked Connor in the chest with a stubby finger.
Connor said quietly, "That's assault."
Jeff said, "Hey, fuck you, buddy. I told you you're in the wrong place."
Connor did something very fast, and Jeff was suddenly down on the floor, moaning in pain. Jeff rolled away, coming to rest against a pair of black trousers. Looking up, I saw that the man wearing the trousers was dressed entirely in black. Black shirt, black tie, black satin jacket. He had white hair and a dramatic Hollywood manner. "I'm Rod Dwyer. This is my home. What seems to be the problem?"
Connor introduced us politely and showed his badge. "We're here on official business. We asked to speak to one of your guests, Mr. Sakamura. Who is the man standing over there in the corner?"
"And this man?" Dwyer asked, pointing to Jeff, who was gasping and coughing on the floor.
Connor said calmly, "He assaulted me."
"I didn't fucking assault him," Jeff said, sitting up on his elbow, coughing.
Dwyer said, "Did you touch him?" Jeff was silent, glowering. Dwyer turned back to us. "I'm sorry this happened. These men are new. I don't know what they were thinking of. Can I get you a drink?"
"Thanks, we're on duty," Connor said. "Let me ask Mr. Sakamura to come over and talk to you. Your name again?"
"Connor."
Dwyer walked away. The first man helped Jeff to his feet. As Jeff limped away, he muttered, "Fucking assholes."
I said, "Remember when police were respected?"
But Connor was shaking his head, looking down at the floor.
"I am very ashamed," he said.
"Why?"
He wouldn't explain further.
"Hey, John! John Connor! He says Shiba read the net. Long time no see. How they hanging, guy? Hey."
He punched Connor in the shoulder. Up close, Eddie Sakamura wasn't so handsome. His complexion was gray, with pockmarked skin, and he smelled like day-old scotch. His movements were edgy, hyperactive, and he spoke quickly. Fast Eddie was not a man at peace.
Connor said, "I'm pretty good, Eddie. How about you? How you doing?"
"Hey, can't complain, Captain. One or two things only. Got a 501, drunk driving. Try to beat that, but you know, with my record, it's getting hard. Hey, life goes on. What are you doing here? Pretty wild place, huh? Latest thing, no furniture. Rod sets new style. Great. Nobody can sit down anymore."
He laughed.
"New style. Great."
I had the feeling he was on drugs. He was too manic. I got a good look at the scar on his left hand. It was purple red, roughly 4 centimeters by 3. It appeared to be an old burn. Connor lowered his voice and said, "Actually, Eddie, we're here about the Yakaigoto at Nakamoto tonight."
"Ah, yes,"
Eddie said, lowering his voice, too. "No surprise she came to a bad end.
That's one Hina Kurata Ona."
"She was perverted?
Why do you say that?" Eddie said,
"Want to step outside?
I like to smoke cigarette, and Rod doesn't allow smoking in the house."
"Okay, Eddie."
We went outside and stood by the edge of the cactus garden. Eddie lit a mild 7 menthol.
"Hey, Captain, I don't know what you heard already so far, but that girl, she fucked some of the people in there. She fucked Rod, some of the other people. So?
We can talk easier out here. Okay with you?"
"Sure."
"I know that girl real well. Real well. You know I'm Hipari Dako, eh?"
"I can't help it. Popular guy. She's all over me, all the time."
"I know that, Eddie. But you say she had problems?"
"Big problems, amigo. Grande problemos. I tell you, she was a sick girl, this girl. She got off on pain."
"World's full of them, Eddie."
He sucked on his cigarette.
"Hey, no," he said. "I'm talking something else. I'm talking how she gets off. When you hurt her real bad, she comes. She's always asking more, more. Do it more. Squeeze harder."
Connor said, "Her neck?"
"Yeah, her neck. Right. Squeeze her neck. Yeah. You heard? And sometimes a plastic bag. You know, dry cleaning bag. Put it over her head and clamp it. Hold it around her neck while you fuck her and she sucks the plastic against her mouth and turns blue in the face. Claws at your back. Gasp and wheeze. Christ almighty. Don't care for that myself.
But I'm telling you, this girl has a pussy. I mean, she gets off. It's wild ride. You remember afterwards. I'm telling you. But for me, too much. Always on the edge, you know? Always a risk. Always pushing the edge. Maybe this time. Maybe this is the last time. You know what I'm saying?
He flicked his cigarette away. It sputtered among the cactus thorns.
Sometimes it's exciting, like Russian roulette. Then I couldn't take it, Captain. Seriously, I couldn't. And you know me, I like a wild time.
I decided that Eddie Sakamura gave me the creeps. I tried to make notes while he talked, but his words were tumbling out, and I couldn't keep up. He lit another cigarette, his hand shaking. He kept talking fast, swinging the glowing tip in the air for emphasis.
"And I mean this girl. It's a problem," Eddie said.
"Okay, pretty girl. She's pretty. But sometimes she can't go out. Looks too bad. Sometimes she needs a lot of makeup, because neck is sensitive skin, man. And hers is bruised. Ring around the collar. Bad.
You saw that, maybe? You see her dead, Captain?"
"Yeah, I saw her."
"So then?"
He hesitated. He seemed to step back, reconsider something. He flicked ash from the cigarette.
"So, was she strangled or what?"
"Yes, Eddie. She was strangled."
He inhaled.
"Yeah, figures."
"Did you see her, Eddie?"
"Me? No. What are you talking about? How could I see her, Captain?"
He exhaled, blowing smoke into the night.
"Eddie, look at me."
Eddie turned toward Connor.
"Look in my eyes. Now tell me, did you see the body?"
"No. Captain, come on."
Eddie gave a nervous little laugh and looked away. He flicked the cigarette so it tumbled in the air, dripping sparks.
"What is this, third degree? No, I didn't see the body."
"Eddie."
"I swear to you, Captain."
"Eddie, how are you involved in this?"
"Me? Shit, not me, Captain. I know the girl, sure. I see her sometimes. I fuck her, sure. What the hell? She's a little weird, but she's fun. A fun girl. Great pussy. That's it, man. That's all of it."
He looked around, lit another cigarette.
"This is a nice cactus garden, huh? Xeriscape, they call it. It's the latest thing. Los Angeles goes back to desert life. It's Hyatarinosa. Very fashionable."
"Eddie."
"Come on, Captain. Give me a break here. We know each other a long time."
"Sure, Eddie, but I have some problems."
"What about the security tapes?" Eddie looked blank, innocent.
"Security tapes?
A man with a scar on his hand and a tie with triangles on it came into the Nakamoto security office and took the security videotapes."
"Fuck! What security office? What are you doing, Captain?"
"Eddie."
"Who said that to you? That's not true, man. Take the security tapes? I never did thing like that. What are you, crazy?"
He twisted his tie, looked at the label.
"This is polo tie, Captain. Ralph Lauren. Polo. A lot of these ties, bet you."
"Eddie, what about the Imperial Arms?"
"What about it?"
"You go there tonight?"
"No."
"You clean up Cheryl's room?"
"What?"
Eddie appeared shocked.
"What? No, clean up her room? Where are you getting all this shit, Captain?"
"The girl across the hall, Julia Young," Connor said. "She told us she saw you tonight with another man, in Cheryl's room at the Imperial Arms."
Eddie threw his arms in the air.
"Jesus, Captain, you listen. That girl wouldn't know she saw me last night or last month, man. That girl is a fucking hophead. You look between her toes, you find the marks. You look under her tongue. Look on her pussy lips. You find them. That's a dream girl, man. She doesn't know when things happen. Man, you come here, give me this. I don't like this."
Eddie tossed his cigarette away and immediately lit another.
"I don't like this one bit. You don't see what's going on?"
"No,"
Connor said.
"Tell me, Eddie, what's going on?"
"This shit's not true, man. None of this true."
He puffed rapidly.
"You know what this is about? It's not about some fucking girl, man. It's about Saturday meetings. The Nichi Beikai, Connor-san. The secret meetings. That's what it's about."
Connor snapped. "Sona bakana."
"No bakana, Connor-san. No bullshit. What does a girl from Texas know about Nichi Beikai?
She knows something. Honto Nanda. And she likes to cause trouble, this girl. She likes to make turmoil.
Eddie, I think maybe you better come in with us.
Fine. Perfect. You do their job for them. For the Kuromaku.
He spun to Connor.
Shit, Captain. Come on. You know how it works. This girl killed at Nakamoto. You know my family. My father is Daimashi. Now, in Osaka, they will read that a girl is killed at Nakamoto, and I am arrested in connection. His son.
Detained.
Detained, whatever. You know what that will mean. Taihanakatoni Naruyo. My father resigned. His company must make apologies to Nakamoto. Perhaps reparations. Give some advantage in business. It is powerful, Osawagini Narazo. You will do this if you take me into your custody.
He flicked his cigarette away.
Hey, you think I did this murder, you arrest me. Fine. But you are just covering your ass. You maybe do a lot of damage to me. Captain, you know this.
Connor said nothing for a long time. There was a long silence. They walked around the garden in circles. Finally, Eddie said,
Connor-san, mata kureyo.
His voice sounded pleading. It seemed like he was asking for a break. Connor sighed. You got your passport, Eddie?
Yeah, sure. Always.
Let's have it.
Yeah, sure. Okay, Captain. Here goes.
Connor glanced at it, handed it to me. I slipped it in my pocket. Okay, Eddie, but this better not be Murina Koto, or you'll be declared persona non grata, Eddie. And I will personally put you on the next plane for Osaka. Wakataka?
Captain, you protect the honor of my family. Oni kiwayo.
And he bowed formally, both hands at his sides. Connor bowed back. I just stared. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Connor was going to let him go. I thought he was crazy to allow it. I handed Eddie my business card and gave my usual speech about how he could call me later if he thought of anything. Eddie shrugged and slipped the card into his shirt pocket as he lit another cigarette. I didn't count. He was dealing with Connor. Eddie started back toward the house, paused.
I have this redhead here. Very interesting, he said. When I leave the party, I go to my house in the hills. You need me. I will be there. Good night, Captain. Good night, Lieutenant.
Good night, Eddie. We went back down the steps. I hope you know what you are doing, I said.
So do I,
Connor said.
Because he seems guilty as hell to me.
Maybe.
If you ask me, it'd be better to take him in. Safer.
Maybe. Want to go back and get him?
No.
He shook his head. My Dairokan says no. I knew that word. It meant sixth sense. The Japanese were big on intuition. I said, yeah, well, I hope you're right. We continued down the steps in the darkness. Anyway, Connor said, I owe him.
For what?
There was a time, a few years ago, when I needed some information. You remember the fugu poisoning business?
No?
Well, anyway, no one in the community would tell me. They stonewalled me, and I needed to know. It was important. Eddie told me. He was scared to do it, because he didn't want anyone to know. But he did it. I probably owe my life to him. We came to the bottom of the stairs.
And did he remind you of that?
He would never remind me. It is my job to remember. I said, that's fine, Captain. All that obligation stuff is fine and noble, and I'm all for interracial harmony. But meanwhile, it's possible that he killed her, stole the tapes, and cleaned up the apartment. Eddie Sakamura looks like a blown-out speedball to me. He acts like a suspect, and we're just walking away, letting him go.
Right.
We kept walking. I thought it over and got more worried. I said, you know, officially, this is my investigation.
Officially, it's Graham's investigation.
Yeah, okay. But we're going to look stupid if it turns out he did it.
Connor sighed as if he was losing patience.
Okay, let's go over it the way you think it might have happened. Eddie kills the girl, right?
Right.
He can see her any time, but he decides to fuck her on the boardroom table, and he kills her. Then he goes down to the lobby and pretends to be a Nakamoto executive, even though the last thing Eddie Sakamura looks like is an executive. But let's say he passes himself off. He manages to dismiss the guard. He takes the tapes. He walks out just as Phillips comes in. Then he goes to Cheryl's apartment to clean that up, but somehow he adds a picture of himself stuck in Cheryl's mirror. Next, he stops by the Bora Bora and tells everybody he's going to a party in Hollywood, where we find him, in a room without furniture, calmly chatting up a redhead. Is that how the evening lays out to you? I said nothing. It didn't make much sense when he put it that way. On the other hand, I just hope he didn't do it. So do I. We came down to the street level. The valet ran to get our car.
You know, I said, the blunt way he talks about things, like putting the bag over her head, it's creepy.
Oh, that doesn't mean anything, Connor said. Remember, Japan has never accepted Freud or Christianity. They've never been guilty or embarrassed about sex. No problem with homosexuality. No problem with kinky sex. Just matter of fact. Some people like it a certain way, so some people do it that way. What the hell? The Japanese can't understand why we get so worked up about a straightforward bodily function. They think we're a little screwed up on the subject of sex, and they have a point.
Connor glanced at his watch. A security car pulled up. The uniformed guard leaned out. Hey, is there a problem at the party up there?
Like what?
A couple of guys get in a fight? Some kind of fight? We had a report phoned in.
I don't know, Connor said. Maybe you better go up and check.
The guard climbed out of his car, hefted a big gut, and started up the stairs. Connor looked back at the high walls.
You know, we have more private security than police now. Everyone's building walls and hiring guards. But in Japan, you can walk into a park at midnight and sit on a bench and nothing will happen to you. You're completely safe, day or night. You can go anywhere. You won't be robbed or beaten or killed. You're not always looking behind you, not always worrying. You don't need walls or bodyguards. Your safety is the safety of the whole society. You're free. It's a wonderful feeling. Here, everybody has to lock themselves up. Lock the door, lock the car. People who spend their whole lives locked up are in prison. It's crazy. It kills the spirit. But it's been so long now that Americans have forgotten what it's like to really feel safe. Anyway, here's our car. Let's get down to the division. We had started driving down the street when the DHD operator called.
Lieutenant Smith, she said, we have a request for special services.
I'm pretty busy, I said. Can the backup take it?
Lieutenant Smith, we have patrol officers requesting special services for a V-dig in Area 19.
She was telling me there was a problem with a visiting dignitary.
I understand, I said, but I've already rolled out on a case. Give it to the backup.
But this is on Sunset Plaza Drive, she said. Aren't you located?
Yes, I said. Now I understood why she was insistent. The call was only a few blocks away.
Okay, I said. What's the problem?
It's a V-Dig DUI, reported in as G-Level plus one. Last name is Rowe.
Okay, I said. We're going.
I hung up the phone and turned the car around.
Interesting, Connor said. G-Level plus one is American government?
Yes, I said.
It's Senator Rowe?
Sounds like it, I said. Driving under the influence.
The black Lincoln sedan had come to a stop on the lawn of a house along the steep part of Sunset Plaza Drive. Two black and whites were pulled up at the curb, red lights flashing. Up on the lawn, a half-dozen people were standing beside the Lincoln. A man in his bathrobe, arms folded across his chest. A couple of girls in short, glittery sequin dresses. A very handsome blonde man, about 40, in a tuxedo. And a younger man in a blue suit, whom I recognized as the young man who had gotten on the elevator with Senator Rowe earlier.
The patrolman had the video camera out, shining the bright light on Senator Rowe. He was propping himself up against the front fender of the Lincoln, holding his arm up to cover his face against the light. He was swearing loudly as Connor and I walked up. The man in the bathrobe came toward us and said, "I want to know who's going to pay for this."
"Just a minute, sir."
I kept walking.
"He can't just ruin my lawn like this. It has to be paid for."
"Just give me a minute, sir."
"Scared the hell out of my wife, too, and she has cancer."
I said, "Sir, please give me a minute, and then I'll talk to you."
"Cancer of the ear," he said emphatically. "The ear."
"Yes, sir. All right, sir." I continued toward the Lincoln and the bright light. As I passed the aide, he fell into step beside me and said,
"I can explain everything, detective."
He was about 30, with the bland good looks of a congressional staffer.
"I'm sure I can resolve everything."
"Just a minute," I said. "Let me talk to the senator."
"The senator's not feeling well," the aide said. "He's very tired."
He stepped in front of me. I just walked around him. He hurried to catch up.
"It's jet lag. That's the problem. The senator has jet lag."
"I have to talk to him," I said, stepping into the bright light. Rowe was still holding up his arm. I said, "Senator Rowe?"
"Turn that fucking thing off, for fuck's sake," Rowe said.
He was heavily intoxicated. His speech so slurred it was difficult to understand him.
"Senator Rowe," I said, "I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to... fuck you and the horse you rode in on."
"Senator Rowe," I said,
"turn that fucking camera off."
I looked back to the patrolman and signaled to him. He reluctantly turned the camera off. The light went out.
"Jesus Christ," Rowe said, finally dropping his arm.
He looked at me with bleary eyes.
"What the fuck is going on here?"
I introduced myself.
"Then why don't you do something about this fucking zoo?" Rowe said. "I'm just driving to my fucking hotel."
"I understand that, Senator."
"Don't know..."
He waved his hand, a sloppy gesture.
"What the fucking problem is around here?"
"Senator, you were driving this car?"
"Fuck, driving."
He turned away.
"Jerry, explain it to him, Christ's sake."
The aide came up immediately.
"I'm sorry about all this," he said smoothly. "The senator isn't feeling at all well. We just came back from Tokyo yesterday evening. Jet lag. He's not himself. He's tired."
"Who was driving the car?" I said.
"I was," the aide said.
"Absolutely."
One of the girls giggled.
"No, he wasn't,"
the man in the bathrobe shouted from the other side of the car.
"He was driving it, and he couldn't get out of the car without falling down."
"Christ, fucking zoo," Senator Rowe said, rubbing his head.
"Detective," the aide said, "I was driving the car, and these two women here will testify that I was."
He gestured to the girls in party dresses, giving them a look.
"That's a goddamn lie," the man in the bathrobe said.
"No, that's correct," the handsome man in the tuxedo said, speaking for the first time. He had a suntan and a relaxed manner, like he was used to having his orders obeyed. Probably a Wall Street guy. He didn't introduce himself.
"I was driving the car," the aide said.
"All gone to shit," Rowe muttered. "Ought to go to my hotel."
"Was anyone hurt here?" I said.
"Nobody was hurt," the aide said. "Everybody is fine."
I asked the patrolman behind me,
"You got a 110 to file?"
That was the report of property damage for vehicular accident.
"We don't need to," the patrolman said to me.
"Single car, and the amount doesn't qualify."
"You only had to fill it out if the damage was more than $200.
"All we got is a 501, if you want to run with that."
I didn't. One of the things you learned about in special services was SAR, Situational Appropriate Response. SAR meant that in the case of elected officials and celebrities, you let it go unless somebody was going to press charges. In practice, that meant that you didn't make an arrest short of a felony. I said to the aide,
"You get the property owner's name and address, so you can deal with the damage to the lawn."
"He already got my name and address," the man in the bathrobe said. "But I want to know what's going to be done."
I told him we'd repair any damage, the aide said. I assured him we would. He seems to be...
Damn it, look! Her planting is ruined, and she has cancer of the ear.
Just a minute, sir. I said to the aide, who's going to drive the car now?
I am, the aide said.
He is, Senator Rowe said, nodding.
Jerry, drive the car.
I said to the aide, all right, I want you to take a breathalyzer.
Sure, yes.
And I want to see your driver's license.
Of course.
The aide blew into the breathalyzer and handed me his driver's license. It was a Texas license. Gerald D. Harden, 34 years old, address in Austin, Texas. I wrote down the details and gave it back. All right, Mr. Harden. I'm going to release the senator into your custody tonight.
Thank you, Lieutenant. I appreciate it.
The man in the bathrobe said,
You're going to let him go?
Just a minute, sir, I said to Harden. I want you to give this man your business card and stay in contact with him. I expect the damage to his yard to be resolved to his satisfaction.
Absolutely, of course, yes.
Harden reached into his pocket for a card. He brought out something white in his hand, like a handkerchief. He stuffed it hastily back in his pocket and then walked over to give his card to the man in the bathrobe.
You're going to have to replace all her begonias.
Fine, sir, Harden said.
All of them?
Yes, that's fine, sir.
Senator Rowe pushed off the front fender, standing unsteadily in the night.
Fucking begonias, he said. Christ, what a fucking night this is.
You got a wife?
No,
I said.
I do, Rowe said. Fucking begonias. Fuck.
This way, Senator, Harden said.
He helped Rowe into the passenger seat. The girls climbed into the back seat, on either side of the handsome Wall Street guy. Harden got behind the wheel and asked Rowe for the keys. I looked away to watch the black and whites as they pulled away from the curb. When I turned back, Harden rolled down the window and looked at me.
Thank you for this.
Drive safely, Mr. Harden, I said. He backed the car off the lawn, driving over a flower bed.
And the irises,
the man in the bathrobe shouted as the car pulled away down the road. He looked at me.
I'm telling you, the other man was driving, and he was drunk.
I said, here's my card. If things don't turn out right, call me. He looked at the card, shaking his head, and went back into his house. Connor and I got back into the car. We drove down the hill. Connor said,
You got information on the aide?
Yes, I said.
What was in his pocket?
I'd say it was a pair of women's panties.
So would I. Connor said.
Of course there was nothing we could do. Personally, I would have liked to spin the smug bastard around, push him up against the car, and search him right there. But we both knew our hands were tied. We had no probable cause to search Harden or to arrest him. He was a young man driving with two young women in the back seat, either of whom might be without her panties, and a drunken United States senator in the front seat. The only sensible thing to do was to let them all go. But it seemed like an evening of letting people go. The phone rang. I pushed the speaker button.
Lieutenant Smith.
Hey, buddy.
It was Graham.
I'm over here at the morgue, and guess what? I have some Japanese bugging me to attend the autopsy. Wants to sit in and observe, if you can believe that shit. He's all bent out of shape because we started the autopsy without him. But the lab work is starting to come back. It's not looking good for Nippon Central. I'd say we have a Japanese perp. So, you coming here or what?
I looked at Connor. He nodded. We're heading there now, I said. The fastest way to the morgue was through the emergency room at County General Hospital. As we went through, a black man covered in blood was sitting up on his gurney screaming,
Kill the Pope! Kill the Pope! Fuck you!
In a drug-crazed frenzy. A half-dozen attendants were trying to push him down. He had gunshot wounds in his shoulder and hand. The floors and walls of the emergency room were spattered with blood. An orderly went down the hall, cleaning it up with a mop. The hallways were lined with black and Hispanic people. Some of them held children in their laps. Everyone looked away from the bloody mop. From somewhere down the corridor, we heard more screams. We got onto the elevator. It was quiet.
Connor said, "A homicide every 20 minutes, a rape every 7 minutes, a child murdered every 4 hours. No other country tolerates these levels of violence." The doors opened. Compared to the emergency room, the basement corridors of the county morgue were positively tranquil. There was a strong odor of formaldehyde. We went to the desk where the thin, angular deaner, Harry Landon, was bent over some papers, eating a ham sandwich. He didn't look up. "Hey, guys."
"Hey, Harry."
"What you here for? Austin prep?"
"Yeah."
"They started about half an hour ago. There's a big rush on her, huh?"
"How's that?"
"The chief called Dr. Tim out of bed and told him to do it pronto. Pissed him off pretty good. You know how particular Dr. Tim is."
The deaner smiled.
"And they called in a lot of lab people, too. Who ever heard of pushing a full workup in the middle of the night? I mean, you know what this is going to cost in overtime?"
I said, "And what about Graham?"
"He's around here someplace. He had some Japanese guy chasing after him, dogging him like a shadow. Then every half hour, the Japanese asks me can he use the phone, and he makes a call. Speaks Japanese a while. Then he goes back to bothering Graham. He says he wants to see the autopsy, if you can believe that. Keeps pushing, pushing. But anyway, the Japanese makes his last call about 10 minutes ago, and suddenly a big change comes over him. I was here at the desk. I saw it on his face. He goes, 'Mojo, mojo,' like he can't believe his ears. And then he runs out of here. I mean it, runs."
"And where's the autopsy?"
"Room 2.
"Thanks, Harry."
"Close the door."
"Hi, Tim," I said as we came into the autopsy room.
Tim Haller, known to everyone as Dr. Tim, was leaning over the stainless steel table. Even though it was 1:40 in the morning, he was, as usual, immaculate. Everything was in place. His hair was neatly combed, his tie was perfectly knotted. The pens were lined up in the pocket of his starched lab coat.
"Did you hear me?"
"I'm closing it, Tim."
The door had a pneumatic self-closing mechanism, but apparently that wasn't fast enough for Dr. Tim.
"It's only because I don't want that Japanese individual looking in."
"He's gone, Tim."
"Oh, is he? But he may be back. He's been unbelievably persistent and irritating."
He glanced over his shoulder.
"And who's that with you? Not John Connor. I haven't seen you in ages, John."
"Hi, Tim." Connor and I approached the table. I could see the dissection was already well advanced, that the Y-shaped incision had been made, and the first organs removed and placed neatly on stainless steel trays.
"Now maybe somebody can tell me. What is the big deal about this case?"
Tim said.
"Graham is so pissed off he won't say anything. He went next door to the lab to see the first of the results. But I still want to know why I got called out of bed to do this one. Mark's on duty, but he is apparently not senior enough to do it. And, of course, the ME is out of town at a conference in San Francisco. Now that he has that new girlfriend, he is always out of town. So I get called. I can't remember the last time I got called out of bed."
"You can't?" I said.
Dr. Tim was precise in all ways, including his memory. "The last time was January 3 years ago. But that was to cover. Most of the staff was out with the flu, and the cases were backing up. Finally, one night we ran out of lockers. They had these bodies lying around on the floor in bags, stacked up in piles. Something had to be done. The smell was terrible. But no, I can't remember being called out just because a case was politically tense, like this one."
Connor said, "We're not sure why it is tense either."
"Maybe you better find out, because there's a lot of pressure here. The ME calls me from San Francisco, and he keeps saying, 'Do it now, do it tonight, and get it done.' I say, 'Okay, Bill.' Then he says, 'Listen, Tim, do this one right. Go slow, take lots of pictures and lots of notes. Document your ass off. Shoot with 2 cameras. Because I got a feeling that anybody who has anything to do with this case could get into deep shit. So, it's natural to wonder what the big deal is."
Connor said, "What time was that call to you?"
"About 10:30, 11.
"The ME say who called him?"
"No, but it's usually only one of 2 people, the chief of police or the mayor."
Tim looked at the liver,
pulling apart the lobes, then placed it on a steel tray. The assistant was taking flash pictures of each organ and then setting it aside.
So, what have you found?
Frankly, the most interesting findings so far are external, Dr. Tim said. She had heavy makeup on her neck to cover a pattern of multiple contusions, bruises of different ages. Without a spectroscopic curve for the hemoglobin breakdown products at the bruise sites, I'd still say these bruises are of variable age, up to 2 weeks old, perhaps older, consistent with a pattern of repeated chronic cervical trauma. I don't think there's any question. We're looking at a case of sexual asphyxia.
She's a gasper?
Yeah, she is.
Kelly thought so.
For once, Kelly was right. It's more common in men, but it is certainly reported in women. The syndrome is the individual is sexually aroused only by the hypoxia of near strangulation. These individuals ask their sexual partners to strangle them or put a plastic bag over their head. When they're alone, they sometimes tie a cord around their neck and hang themselves while they masturbate. Since the effect requires that they are strangled almost to the point of passing out, it's easy to make a mistake and go too far. They do, all the time.
And in this case?
Tim shrugged. Well, she has physical findings consistent with a sexual asphyxia syndrome of long standing. And she has ejaculate in her vagina and abrasions on her external vaginal labia, consistent with a forced sexual episode on the same night of her death.
Connor said, "You're sure the vaginal abrasions occurred before death?"
"Oh, yes. They are definitely anti-mortem injuries. There's no question she had forced sex sometime before she died."
"Are you saying she was raped?"
"No, I wouldn't go that far. As you see, the abrasions are not severe, and there are no associated injuries to other parts of her body. In fact, there are no signs of physical struggle at all. So I would consider the findings consistent with premature vaginal entry with insufficient lubrication of the external labia."
I said, "You're saying she wasn't wet?"
Tim looked pained. "Well, in crude layman's terms."
"How long before death did these abrasions occur?"
"It could be as much as an hour or two. It wasn't near the actual time of death. You can tell that from the extravasation and swelling of the affected areas. If death occurs soon after the injury, blood flow stops, and therefore the swelling is limited or absent. In this case, as you see, swelling is quite pronounced."
"And the sperm?"
"Samples have gone to the lab, along with all her usual fluids."
He shrugged.
"Have to wait and see. Now, are you two going to fill me in? Because it looks to me like this little girl was going to get in trouble sooner or later. I mean, she's cute, but she's screwed up. So, what is the big deal? Why am I out of bed in the middle of the night to do a careful, documented post on some little gasper?"
I said, "Beats me."
"Come on, fair is fair," Dr. Tim said. "I showed you mine, now you show me yours."
"Why, Tim," Connor said, "you made a joke."
"Fuck you," Tim said. "You guys owe me. Come on."
"I'm afraid Peter is telling you the truth," Connor said.
"All we know is that this murder occurred at the time of a big public Japanese reception, and they are eager to get it cleared up right away." "That makes sense," Tim said. "The last time the shit hit the fan around here, it was because of that thing involving the Japanese consulate. Remember? The Takashima kidnapping case? Maybe you don't remember. It never made the papers. The Japanese managed to keep it very quiet. But anyway, a guard was killed under odd circumstances, and for 2 days, they put a hell of a pressure on our office. I was amazed what they could do. We had Senator Rowe calling us in person, telling us what to do. The governor calling in person. Everybody calling us. You'd think it was the president's kid. I mean, these people have influence."
"Of course they do. They've paid handsomely for it," Graham said, coming into the room.
"Close the door," Tim said.
"But this time, all their fucking influence won't help," Graham said. "Because this time, we have them by the short and curlies. We have a murder, and based on the lab results so far,
we can say without question that the murderer was Japanese. The pathology lab next door was a large room lit by even banks of fluorescent lights. Rows of microscopes neatly laid out. But late at night, only two technicians were working in the big space, and Graham was standing beside them, gloating.
Look for yourself. Pubic hair comb through reveals male pubic hair, moderate curl, ovoid cross-section, almost certainly Asian in origin. The first semen analysis is blood type, AB, relatively rare among Caucasians, but much more common among Asians. The first analysis of protein in the seminal fluid comes up negative for the genetic marker for, what's it called? Ethanol dehydrogenase, the technician said. Right, ethanol dehydrogenase. It's an enzyme, missing in Japanese, and missing in this seminal fluid. And there's the Diego factor, which is a blood group protein. So, we have more tests coming, but it seems clear that this girl had forced sex with a Japanese man before she was killed by him. It's clear you found evidence of Japanese semen in her vagina, Connor said. That's all.
Christ, Graham said. Japanese semen, Japanese pubic hair, Japanese blood factors. We are talking a Japanese perp here.
He had set out some pictures from the crime scene, showing Cheryl lying on the boardroom table. He started to pace back and forth in front of them.
I know where you guys have been, and I know you've been wasting your time, Graham said. You went for videotapes, but they're gone, right? Then you went to her apartment, but it was cleaned up before you ever got there, which is exactly what you'd expect if the perp is Japanese. It lays right out, plain as can be.
Graham pointed to the pictures.
There's our girl, Cheryl Austin, from Texas. She's cute, fresh, good figure. She's an actress, sort of. She does a few commercials. Maybe a Nissan commercial. Whatever. She meets some people, makes some contacts, gets on some lists. You with me?
Yes, I said to Graham. Connor was staring intently at the pictures.
One way or another, our Cheryl's doing well enough to be wearing a black Yamamoto gown when she gets invited to the grand opening of the Nakamoto Tower. She comes with some guy, maybe a friend or a hairdresser. A beard. Maybe she knows other people at the party, and maybe not. But in the course of the evening, somebody big and powerful suggests they slip away for a while. She agrees to go upstairs. Why not? This girl likes adventure. She likes danger. She's cruising for a bruising. So she goes upstairs. Maybe with the other guy, maybe separately. But anyway, they meet upstairs, and they look around for a place to do it. A place that's exciting. And they decide, him probably, he decides, to do it right on the fucking boardroom table. So they start doing it. They're wanging away, but things get out of hand. Her lover boy gets a little too worked up, or else he's kinky, and he squeezes her neck a little too hard. And she's dead. You with me so far?
Yes.
So now lover boy has a problem. He's come upstairs to fuck a girl, but unfortunately he's killed her. So what does he do? What can he do? He goes back down, rejoins the party, and since he is a big samurai coxman, he tells one of his underlings that he has this little problem. He has unfortunately snuffed out the life of a local whore. Very inconvenient for his busy schedule. So the underlings run around and clean up the boss's mess. They clean up incriminating evidence from the floor upstairs. They remove the videotapes. They go to her apartment and remove evidence there. Which is all fine, except it takes time. So somebody has to stall the police. And that's where their smoothie suck-ass lawyer Ishigara comes in. He delays us a good hour and a half. So, how does that sound?
There was a silence when he had finished. I waited for Connor to speak.
Well, Connor said at last, my hat is off to you, Tom. That sequence of events sounds correct in many respects.
You're damned right it does, Graham puffed up. Damn fucking right.
The telephone rang. The lab technician said, is there a Captain Connor here?
Connor went to answer the phone. Graham said, I'm telling you, a Jap killed this girl, and we are going to find him and fucking flay him.
Flay him.
I said,
"Why do you have it in for them anyway?"
Graham gave me a sullen look. He said,
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm talking about how you hate the Japanese."
"Hey, listen," Graham said. "Let's get something straight, Petey-san. I don't hate anybody. I do my job. Black man, white man, Japanese man. It makes no difference to me."
"Okay, Tom." It was late at night. I didn't want to argue.
"No, hell. You fucking think I'm prejudiced."
"Let's just drop it, Tom."
"No, hell. We're not going to drop it. Not now. Let me tell you something, Petey-san. You got yourself this fucking liaison job. Isn't that right?"
"That's right, Tom."
"And how come you applied for it? Because of your great love of Japanese culture?"
"Well, at the time, I was working in the press office."
"No, no, cut the shit. You applied for it," Graham said, "because there was an extra stipend, isn't that right? 2-3 thousand a year. An educational stipend. It comes into the department from the Japan-America Amity Foundation. And the department allows it as an educational stipend, paid to members of the force so that they can further their education in Japanese language and culture. So, how are those studies going, Petey-san?"
"I'm studying."
"How often?"
"One night a week."
"One night a week. And if you miss classes, do you lose your stipend?"
"No."
"Fucking right you don't. In fact, it doesn't make any difference if you go to classes at all. The fact is, buddy, you got yourself a bribe. You got $3,000 in your pocket, and it comes right from the land of the rising sun. Of course, it's not that much. Nobody can buy you for $3,000, right?"
"Of course not."
"Hey, Tom. But the thing is, they aren't buying you. They're just influencing you. They just want you to think twice, to tend to look favorably upon them. And why not? It's human nature. They've made your life a little better. They contribute to your well-being, your family, your little girl. They scratch your back, so why shouldn't you scratch theirs? Isn't that about it, Petey-san?"
"No, it isn't," I said. I was getting angry.
"Yes, it is,"
Graham said, "because that's how influence works. It's deniable. You say it isn't there. You tell yourself it isn't there, but it is. The only way you can be clean is to be clean, man. If you got no stake in it, if you got no income from it, then you can talk. Otherwise, man, they pay you, and I say they own you."
"Just a fucking minute. So don't talk to me about hating, man. This country is in a war, and some people understand it, and some other people are siding with the enemy. Just like in World War II, some people were paid by Germany to promote Nazi propaganda. New York newspapers published editorials right out of the mouth of Adolf Hitler. Sometimes the people didn't even know it. But they did it. That's how it is in a war, man. And you are a fucking collaborator."
I was grateful when, at that moment, Connor came back to where we were standing. Graham and I were about to square off when Connor said calmly,
"Now, just so I understand, Tom, according to your scenario, after the girl was murdered, what happened to the tapes?"
"Oh, hell, those tapes are gone," Graham said. "You're never going to see those tapes again."
"Well, it's interesting, because that call was the division headquarters. It seems Mr. Ishigara is there, and he's brought a box of videotapes with him for me to look at."
Connor and I drove over. Graham took his own car. I said, "Why did you say the Japanese would never touch Graham?"
"Graham's uncle," Connor said. "He was a prisoner of war during World War II. He was taken to Tokyo, where he disappeared. Graham's father went over after the war to find out what happened to him. There were unpleasant questions about what happened. You probably know that some American servicemen were killed in terminal medical experiments in Japan. There were stories about the Japanese feeding their livers to subordinates as a joke. Things like that."
"No, I didn't know," I said.
"I think everybody would prefer to forget that time," Connor said, "and move on. And probably correctly. It's a different country now."
"What was Graham going on about?"
"My stipend as a liaison officer."
Connor said, "You told me it was 50 a week."
"It's a little more than that."
"How much more?"
"About $100 a week. $5,500 a year.
But that's to cover classes and books and commuting expenses, babysitters, everything."
"So you get $5,000, Connor said.
"So what?"
Graham was saying I was influenced by it, that the Japanese had bought me.
Connor said, "Well, they certainly try to do that, and they're extremely subtle."
"They tried it with you?"
"Oh, sure."
He paused.
"And often I accepted. Giving gifts to ensure that you will be seen favorably is something the Japanese do by instinct. And it's not so different from what we do when we invite the boss over for dinner. Goodwill is goodwill. But we don't invite the boss over for dinner when we're up for a promotion. The proper thing to do is to invite the boss early in the relationship, when nothing is at stake. Then it's just goodwill. The same with the Japanese. They believe you should give the gift early, because then it is not a bribe. It is a gift. A way of making a relationship with you before there is any pressure on the relationship.
And you think that's okay?
I think it's the way the world works.
Do you think it's corrupting?
Connor looked at me and said, "Do you?"
I took a long time to answer.
"Yes, I think maybe so."
He started to laugh.
"Well, that's a relief," he said. "Because otherwise, the Japanese would have wasted all their money on you."
"What's so funny?"
"Your confusion, Kohai.
Graham thinks it's a war."
Connor said, "Well, that's true. We are definitely at war with Japan. But let's see what surprises Mr. Ishigara has for us in the latest skirmish."
As usual, the fifth-floor anteroom of the downtown detective division was busy, even at 2 o'clock in the morning. Detectives moved among the beat-up prostitutes and twitching druggies brought in for questioning. In the corner, a man in a checked sport coat was shouting,
"I said shut the fuck up!"
over and over to a female officer with a clipboard. In all the swirl and noise, Kasagoro Ishigara looked distinctly out of place. Wearing his blue pinstripe suit, he sat in the corner with his head bowed and his knees pressed together. He had a cardboard box balanced on his knees. When he saw us, he jumped to his feet. He bowed deeply, placing his hands flat on his thighs, a sign of additional respect. He held the bow for several seconds. Then he immediately bowed again, and this time he waited, bent over, staring at the floor, until Connor spoke to him in Japanese. Ishigara's reply, also in Japanese, was quiet and deferential. He kept looking at the floor. Tom Graham pulled me over by the water cooler.
"Holy Christ," he said. "It looks like we got a fucking confession happening here."
"Yeah, maybe," I said. I wasn't convinced. I'd seen Ishigara change his demeanor before. I watched Connor as he talked to Ishigara. The Japanese man remained hangdog. He kept looking at the floor.
"I never would have figured him," Graham said.
"Not in a million years. Never him."
"How is that?"
"Are you kidding? To kill the girl and then to stay in the room and order us around. What fucking nerves of steel. But look at him now. Christ, he's almost crying."
It was true. Tears seemed to be welling up in Ishigara's eyes. Connor took the box and turned away, crossing the room to us. He gave me the box.
"Deal with this. I'm going to take a statement from Ishigara."
"So," Graham said, "did he confess?"
"To what?"
"The murder."
"Hell no," Connor said.
"What makes you think that?"
"Well, he's over there bowing and scraping."
"That's just sumimasen," Connor said.
"I wouldn't take it too seriously."
"He's practically crying," Graham said.
"Only because he thinks it'll help him."
"He didn't confess?"
"No, but he discovered that the tapes had been removed after all. That means he made a serious mistake with his public blustering in front of the mayor. Now he could be accused of concealing evidence. He could be disbarred. His corporation could be disgraced. Ishigara is in big trouble, and he knows it."
I said, "And that's why he's so humble?"
"Yes. In Japan, if you screw up, the best thing is to go to the authorities and make a big show of how sorry you are, and how bad you feel, and how you will never do it again. It's pro forma. But the authorities will be impressed by how you've learned your lesson. That's sumimasen. Apology without end.
It's the Japanese version of throwing yourself on the mercy of the court. It's understood to be the best way to get leniency. And that's all Ishigarai is doing.
You mean it's an act? Graham said, his eyes hardening.
Yes and no. It's difficult to explain.
Look, review the tapes. Ishigarai says he brought one of the VCRs, because the tapes are recorded in an unusual format, and he was afraid we wouldn't be able to play them. Okay?
I opened the cardboard box. I saw 20 small 8mm cartridges, like audio cassette cartridges. And I saw a small box, the size of a Walkman, which was the VCR. It had cables to hook to a TV.
Okay, I said. Let's have a look.
The first of the tapes that showed the 46th floor was a view from the atrium camera, high up, looking down. The image was black and white. The tape showed people working on the floor in what looked like an ordinary office day. We fast-forwarded through that. Shadows of sunlight coming through the windows swung in hot arcs across the floor and then disappeared. Gradually, the light on the floor softened and dimmed as daylight came to an end. One by one, desk lights came on. The workers moved more slowly now. Eventually, they began to depart, leaving their desks one by one. As the population thinned, we noticed something else. Now the camera moved occasionally, panning one or another of the workers as they passed beneath. Yet at other times, the camera would not pan. Eventually, we realized that the camera must be equipped for automatic focusing and tracking. If there was a lot of movement in the frame, several people going in different directions, then the camera did not move. But if the frame was mostly empty, the camera would fix on a single person walking through and track him.
Funny system, Graham said.
It probably makes sense for a security camera, I said. They'd be much more concerned about a single person on the floor than a crowd. As we watched, the night lights came on. The desks were all empty. Now the tape began to flicker rapidly, almost like a strobe.
Something wrong with this tape? Graham said suspiciously. They fucked around with it?
I don't know. No, wait, it's not that. Look at the clock. On the far wall, we could see the office clock. The minute hands were sweeping smoothly from 7:30 toward 8 o'clock.
It's time-lapse, I said.
What is it, taking snapshots?
I nodded.
Probably, when the system doesn't detect anybody for a while, it begins to take single frames every 10 or 20 seconds until...
Hey, what's that?
The flickering had stopped. The camera had begun to pan to the right, across the deserted floor. But there was nobody in the frame. Just empty desks and occasional night lights which flared in the video.
Maybe they have a wide sensor, I said. That looks beyond the borders of the image itself.
Either that, or it's being moved manually by a guard somewhere. Maybe down in the security room. The panning image came to rest on the elevator doors. The doors were at the far right, in deep shadow, beneath a kind of ceiling overhang that blocked our view.
Geez, dark under there. Is someone there?
I can't see anything, I said. The image began to swim in and out of focus.
What's happening now? Graham said.
Looks like the automatic focus is having trouble.
Maybe it can't decide what to focus on. Maybe the overhang is bothering the logic circuits.
My video camera at home does the same thing. The focus gets screwed up when it can't tell what I am shooting.
So is the camera trying to focus on something? Because I can't see anything. It just looks black under there.
No, look. There's someone there. You can see pale legs, very faint.
Christ, Graham said. That's our girl, standing by the elevator. No, wait, now she's moving.
A moment later, Cheryl Austin stepped from beneath the ceiling overhang, and we saw her clearly for the first time. She was beautiful and assured. She moved unhesitatingly into the room. She was direct, purposeful in her movements, with none of the awkward, shuffling sloppiness of the young.
Jesus, she's good-looking, Graham said.
Cheryl Austin was tall and slender. Her short blonde hair made her seem even taller. Her carriage was erect. She turned slowly, surveying the room as if she owned it.
I can't believe we're seeing this, Graham said.
I knew what he meant. This was a girl who had been killed just a few hours before. Now we were seeing her on a videotape, walking around just minutes before her death. On the monitor, Cheryl picked up a paperweight on one of the desks, turned it in her hand, put it back. She opened her purse, closed it again. She glanced at her watch.
Starting to fidget.
She doesn't like to be kept waiting, Graham said. And I bet she doesn't have much practice at it either. Not a girl like that.
She began to tap on the desk with her fingers in a distinct rhythm. It seemed familiar to me.
She bobbed her head to the rhythm. Graham squinted at the screen.
Is she talking? Is she saying something?
It looks like it, I said. We could barely see her mouth moving. And then I suddenly put it together. Her movements, everything. I realized I could sync her lips.
I chew my nails and I twiddle my thumbs. I'm real nervous, but it sure is fun. Oh, baby, you drive me crazy.
Jesus, Graham said. You're right. How'd you know that?
Goodness gracious, great balls of...
Cheryl stopped singing. She turned toward the elevators.
Ah, here we go.
Cheryl walked toward the elevators. Just as she stepped beneath the overhang, she threw her arms around the man who had arrived. They embraced and kissed warmly. But the man remained beneath the overhang. We could see his arms around Cheryl, but we could not see his face.
Shit,
Graham said.
Don't worry, I said. We'll see him in a minute. If not this camera, another camera. But I think we can say this is not somebody she just met. This is somebody she already knows.
Not unless she's real friendly. Yeah, look, this guy isn't wasting any time. The man's hand slid up the black dress, raising her skirt. He squeezed her buttocks. Cheryl Austin pressed against his body. Their clinch was intense, passionate. Together they moved deeper into the room, turning slowly. Now the man's back was to us. Her skirt was bunched around her waist. She reached down to rub his crotch. The couple half walked, half stumbled to the nearest desk. The man bent her back against the desk, and suddenly she protested, pushing him away.
Uh-uh, not so fast, Graham said. Our girl has standards, after all.
I wondered if that was it. Cheryl seemed to have led him on, then changed her mind. I noticed that she had changed moods almost instantaneously. It made me wonder if she had been acting all along, if her passion was faked. Certainly the man did not seem particularly surprised by her sudden change. Sitting up on the desk, she kept pushing at him, almost angrily. The man stepped away. His back was still to us. We couldn't see his face. As soon as he had stepped back, she changed again. Smiling, kittenish now. With slow movements, she got off the desk and adjusted her skirt, twisting her body provocatively as she looked around. We could see his ear and the side of his face, just enough to see that his jaw was moving. He was talking to her. She smiled at him and came forward, slid her arms around his neck. Then they began kissing again, their hands moving over each other. Walking slowly through the office, toward the conference room.
So, did she choose the conference room?
Hard to say.
Shit, I still can't see his face.
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.